session of 106.01, reel 12.
Mr. Cottier, Reel 12. You were describing the embarkation procedure onto the Empress of Canada at Glasgow. Can you take up your story from where you left?
Well, the embarkation went very smooth, single file up the gangplank. Top of the gangplank, there was naval personnel to divert us off to various parts of the ship. Troops went down below in the mess decks. Very poor accommodation. Cramped like sardines, sleeping in hammocks, which they weren't accustomed to, and didn't even know how to sling a hammock. They were given instruction by a naval personnel how to sling a hammock, but even so, the problem was getting into the hammock. They weren't used to this sort of thing. And a very stuffy atmosphere, no smoking. Meals were very bad. That was for the other ranks. For the NCOs, they shared bunks. One of the NCOs had to sleep on the floor, which a four bunk berth took five, one on the floor, and I think they took turns each night who slept on the floor. My accommodation was a bit better. Me being provost sergeant, I was shared a bunk with the Marshal at Arms, who was the equivalent in the Navy. He's like the provost sergeant of the ship. So I shared a bunk with him, and I was a little bit better off. And I dined in the PO's mess, where the sergeants dined on the mess decks, on a mess deck, especially for sergeants, and the men dined on their own mess decks.
In your mess, were you waited upon by...
Yes, by the steward. And the food was a lot better. I had fresh buns and butter, buns baked by the ship, and which the troops didn't get. They got bread, like, but... I think it was stored aboard. It wasn't a fresh big deal like ours was.
And what about the officers?
Well, I don't know about the officers, but I think, judging by the way I was treated, they'd be a lot better. And if they're any better than me, they must have been good.
What about washing facilities and so on board ship?
Again, it was cramped washing facilities, ablutions. But then again, you had plenty of time. You know, it wasn't a question of standing the queue. Half dozen blokes would go along, another half dozen would go back. There was no congestion, but the facility was just bare, wash basin, you know, and showers. It wasn't nothing salubrious.
Was there any provision for entertainment or ways to while away the time?
No, none whatsoever. Except for bingo, and of course the illegal anchor board, Crown Anchor, which was illegal. And
as a provost sergeant, did you have to go break up the Crown Anchor?
Yeah, I had to break it up. As a matter of fact, for years I had the board in the home. I brought it up in home with me, confiscated, you know. Because this led to thieving. They were putting big stakes on, and next day you'd hear somebody lost his wallet or lost his money in the Crown Anchor. So I had a special role on the ship. When I went aboard the ship, bear in mind you had three battalions. So now you had three provost sergeants plus the military police. Plus the military police. Well, I was put in charge of cells and troop decks. Well, the military police had the cushy end. They patrolled the sun decks, you know, the open decks. where there was very little activity, because the Crown Anchor took place downstairs on the mess, you see. So that's how I come out to keep patrolling the mess and breaking it up. I was in charge of sales, and I was also in charge of ship's inspections party. This meant that I had to, every morning, precede the Commodore, because it was a Commodore ship we were on, the captain, and OC troops on ship's inspection. I had to go in front of them and shout, "Stand up, ship's inspection," or "ship's officers." Now, the Nemtsov kind of being a big ship, I had a bit of a problem. So before the ship actually sailed, about 2 days before we sailed, I spent quite a lot of time on the Persa Square looking at the diagram, the route, because you had to go down companies, up companyways, and you could easily get lost. And as a matter of fact, on one occasion, I did get lost. And what used to happen, I used to meet the staff, the Commodore, the captain, OC troops, on the Persa Square at 10 o'clock in the morning. He'd say, "Right, proceed," and I used to set away in front. And my purpose was to shout, "Stand up, ship's officers." Well, once they got through, it was just about walking through there, all the troops were sitting at the tables with the utensils at each table highly polished, everything put away tidy, and that was it. Just walked through. It only took you about 3/4 an hour to do the whole ship. But there was one morning, and of course, once you'd walked through, there was upheaval. Out come the cards, the dominoes, everything was a mess. There was one morning, I got lost, and I did the same deck twice. "Stand up, ship's inspection." Well, everything was chaotic. I don't want to be in there. Nothing said, I just walked through. I think I must have realised I'd made a mistake. And that's the only mistake I made. And that was my job throughout the ship. I think about 3 months it took us to go abroad.
Was that done every morning?
Every morning, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Would that include weekends as well?
No, I didn't do it on a Sunday. You had the church service on a Sunday. Every tour the troops massed on the deck. But this would count every morning for the full voyage.
Were there any exercises on board, for example? Yes. Lifeboat drills and things like that?
We had lifeboat drills about twice a week. And our OC troops, I forget who he was now, OC troops of the ship, he decided that to have a route march on the ship, around the decks, which you could have. But he soon got that stopped. Ship's captain stopped that. It was making the best of the decks, the boots, ammunition boots, stamp, stamp, stamping. So we had a route march in stocking feet. Tell me the likes of it. Route marching in stocking feet. Of course we had the PT, Swedish drill.
When did these exercises take place?
Well, mostly after breakfast, after ship's inspection. Because come afternoon, if you're mid-Atlantic, it was pretty warm. You know, you get into the tropics and you're getting affected by prickly heat, which wasn't very pleasant.
Were you, you said you were in a large convoy. Were you aware of the dangers of U-boats?
Oh, yes. We had a hell of an escort. What flying Sunderland boats took it out so far. Then we were met by destroyers. And everywhere you looked, there was a ship. A destroyer, something. Everywhere you looked, as far as the eye could see. It's a massive convoy. Of course, this convoy left from various ports in channels, you know, all over the country, various ports. Then they converged in the channel, made up one big convoy. And as I say, what the Sunderland flying boats picked up, what the RAF for so far, then the ships took over. And me being on the Commodore ship was very interesting. All the signals was coming in from other ships. You could see them flashing signals into the Commodore. And I spent quite a lot of time just on the upper deck watching the ships and that.
Was there any instances where you were attacked at all? Were any danger?
No, there were scares. The ship was ringed every 10 yards with a man and a rifle looking for mines. You see? And if they spotted the mine, he shouted, I forget what the signal was, a blow whistle or something, and point the direction, and everybody opened fire to try and smash the spikes on the mine before it hit the ship. And not our ship, but a ship neighbouring to us got the alert, and the mine just passed their bows. And that's the only scare we had. We weren't troubled at all. We did submarine drill, zigzagging all the way. That's how it took us along. It took us about 3 months to get to India. And that's how it took us along. But we were never worried. I mean, I often just think over. Because the cell's right down the bows of the ship. The cells. I should think, God, if a mine hits this, we don't stand a chance. Right down there, we'll never get out. Because they had the automatic iron doors. Watertight doors, you know, automatic closing. And there's one just where the cells was. And I think, God, if they get the alarm here, we are locked in. But that's the thing I was worried about, being in the bowels of the ship and the ship being hit. I wasn't worried about being on the top deck and being hit.
Yes, you said you had submarine drill. What was that?
Well, the siren went, and everybody just made a dash for their own station. In your bunks, there was a notice up telling you which was your station. You see?
So you had to go below decks, basically, if there was submarine...
No, top. Up on top. All up on top. You had arrows pointing to Z station, B station. Well, you ignored all the other arrows, and you just went followed the B station, or the, and you eventually come to the station to be a member of the Royal Navy standing, an officer, sorting us all out, you see? Now, he had a list of names who should be at that station. And you just called the roll, and you're dismissed. Of course, you know, nature being where it is, instead of the troops themselves saying, right now, where do I go in the event of an emergency, pre-plant themselves, they didn't. They start looking for the arrows when the siren is gone. And they would go, oh, everybody's all mixed up, like a proper traffic jam. But if everybody could have had a little bit practice on their own, said, well, I turned after you, my arrow, it would have went like clockwork. But you've got a lot of blokes stumbling, falling down on the companionways and turn round, going back and shouting at each other and, you know.
How often was this practiced?
Oh, twice a week.
They eventually got the hang of it?
Oh, yeah, they got quite good, the finish. At the finish, we begin to get sick of it, the finish.
Was lifeboat drill similar? Or different stations to stand by?
Oh, no, it's all the same. Emergency station, no matter what it was. Aircraft attack. You all had to go up the top deck, no matter what it was. And, of course, just where your station was, there was a lifeboat. And they were tested.
You mentioned the cells. Was there many problems with discipline on board ship? Were there many
no, not really. The cells that I had, the men that I had them from the Royal Welsh, usually the Royal Berks, and the Royal Artillery. Because I took all the cells, obviously. And there were men who were already serving sentence, come aboard with a sentence, you see. And, of course, they were released on board ship when the sentence expired. And after I'd been at sea about a fortnight, I had a pretty easy time. I had had nobody in cells, except the odd drunk, which is sticking in overnight, getting drunk in the canteen. I don't know how the hell they drunk the beer, like, tar from what I gather, but there wasn't much of it. But to see, you got blokes who didn't drink, and some blokes used to go up and get a mess can, you see, and buy my beer, for instance. But I didn't drink, and they'll come down with a mess can full of beer, and they'll sit and dip the mugs in on the mess decks drinking. That's where you got your trouble, not in the canteen.
Was there much drunkenness?
Not a great lot, no. Considering those hell of our troops abroad, must have been, 1,000, 4,000, I think it was 5,000 troops. Because you had DLI, Royal Berks, Royal Welsh, Royal Artillery, Engineers, the Military Police, you had the Medical Corps. You had a full division, nearly.
Did the different regiments get on with one another? Was there any sort of rivalry between them?
No, no rivalry between them. They were segregated to an extent in accommodation, but they were allowed to walk about freely, mix and canteen on the upper decks. There was no rivalry.
What about the people that you had to work with? You said they all came from different regiments. Did they?
Any
problem there?
The rules for them is the same for any regiment. Detention rules is the same throughout the army. You see, they knew the drill as well as me, sort of thing.
I just meant in terms of these are new faces, new people.
You see, the new faces, new people. But the thing is, I'm provost sergeant, and they're serving a sentence. They know what their provost sergeant was like, so I'll be the same. I knew what detention men were like, so these would be the same. You know what I mean? The only thing was the toughies we used to, the Welsh, you know, the language, because you've got a lot of Welshmen from deep down in the valleys, and there was real Welsh. And when I went in, I shouted, "Davis! Which Davis?" Because, umpteen Davis, you know, Davis 69, Davis 21. That's what you had to go by. The last two numbers, regimental number. Only time I had a bit of laugh.
But you were also working with men from other regiments in terms of the military police or the regimental police on the
troop decks.
Yeah, did you get on with them? Were they easy to work with?
Well, when I used to patrol the mess decks, I just used to look for a huddle. There you knew there's a crown anchor board. Cards I never bothered with. You see him playing cards and gambling, so money on the table, I didn't bother with that. I used to walk straight through and ignore it. But when I saw a big huddle, I knew then that was a crown anchor board. And strange though it may seem, it's often said later, they don't know how I wasn't lynched. I just used to walk in and say, "Right, leave it." Well, someone would grab the dice. That was easy. Hid. And I wasn't going to search out where the dice was. So I just used to take the board, stop from playing. You see, and I didn't take any action against them. And I got three, I think, all together, crown anchor boards. It still went on. I didn't stop it. It still went on. I just, not as much, that was all. And it was still going on. And there was no repercussions from it. You know, it's just something I had to do. I just did it. If there any questions, I'd say, "Well, I've got three anchor boards here. Crown anchor board, clear cloth, you know, square cloth." It was just evidence that I had been on the prowl. Probably a lot more.
How often did you walk around like that, looking for...
Twice a day. It was enough.
Did you do it on your own, or did you go with other...
No, not on my own. Because I'd experienced taking anybody with you, you're in sight and trouble. When you went yourself, they knew you didn't intend to make an arrest. And they were content just to let you take the board and forget about it. But if I went with two or three blokes, they knew that I was going to make an arrest. Then I might get a bit hassled. And really, I didn't want to make any arrests.
One thing occurs to me. You mentioned earlier on prickly heat as you got near the tropics. Was there a problem with health?
Not as such. Prickly heat was the only thing. We did have one death on the board going out. A chap, appendicitis, took ill. And we buried him at sea. But prickly heat was the only thing that I know of. We had a couple of blokes with VD, which they contracted just prior to coming on board and developed. But that was all.
Were you given salt tablets and things like this?
Oh, yes, I'm given salt tablets. Uh-huh.
You mentioned the death a second ago. Was that... given a full ceremony?
Yes.
The whole ship turn out for that?
Yes. The whole ship didn't turn out, but they had the bugles there and last post and reveille and the flag and everything. And, you know, on the slush.
Right. You were on this journey for 3 months. Did you stop at any other ports of call?
Yes. First of all, we stopped at Cape Town, but nobody went ashore. We stopped at Cape Town for a day, I think, to take on water and rations or something. But we didn't go ashore. We lay off. And we were entertained by the divers, the kids diving for tanners. You know, you could throw sixpence over. These native boys would dive deep down for it and come up in his mouth, and we thought that was great. And they caught the Glasgow tanner. They shouted, "Glasgow tanner, Sab," because we come from Glasgow. They knew where we were going from. And we should throw sixpences over And if you threw a halfpenny silver paper on you, they wouldn't die for it. And of course the bum boats came alongside. Bum boats selling fruit and silks and articles, you know. Used to throw your money down, they put in a string. Used to pull whatever you want up in a little basket. Called the bum boats. They were good, you know, just like two-man canoes, you know. And the swell of the sea, they were good. Just come out and, what have you got there? Coconuts, bananas, you know. How much? Sixpence. And you throw the sixpence down, they could catch it. They went to the side, they were over the side and get it. Then they'll put the bananas, coconut in the little basket, and you hold it up.
That was
then we went to, after that, we stopped at Cape Town.
Oh, where were you describing there, then?
Freetown.
Freetown. And you didn't actually land there?
Nobody went ashore, nobody.
And then you moved on to Cape Town?
Then we moved on to Cape Town. We stopped there for, I think, 4 days.
Was shore leave allowed?
Yes. Uh-huh. Battalion went to a camp called Retreat Camp. Retreat Camp. Old battalion. I don't know about the other battalions, how they managed, but I do know when we pulled up alongside, there's a long, long line of cars waiting to take us ashore, civilians, population. But our battalion went to retreat camp, where there's swimming pools and one thing and another, and ice creams and, you know, beer and what have you. But the other troops, they were picked up by families. I was picked up by a family because I didn't go to the battalion, because when I went on board ship, I was classified as ship staff. You see? Officially, I had nothing to do with the battalion. I was ship staff. So I didn't go to retreat with the battalion. I stopped on board ship. But by this time, I'd gotten rid of me prisoners and everything, and I was free. And the sergeant of the military police, Sergeant Hume and I, went down the gang plant and we went in this car. And we were looked after by these people. And he was a building contractor, big building contractor. He was like building a big house estate. And he took us all around. We stopped at his house, had a good time. He took us around Tabletop Mountain and, you know, that his wife wrote letters home saying that we'd passed through and had a good time, this, you know, looked after us. But the idea, when I came back on the ship again and spoke to the Marshal at Arms about it, he was an old salty from the First World War. He laughed. He said, yes. He said, and he says, they give you every encouragement to go back after the war. I said, yes, they did. Uh-huh. He says, the idea is, you know, he says, to give you an oil painting of Africa. And he says, what they want you to do is fetch your family out there so you can spread the population, because they're getting frightened of the black population getting stronger than the white. And they want the white population reinforced. And the only way they can do it, he says, it's like a recruiting campaign. He says, they would give me a good time with you. But he says, when you come out, if you do come out, he says, once you're out, they'll drop it like a hot brick. And I found that to be true. Years later. He said, they'll drop it like a hot brick. I'm pleased I didn't go out.
Were you actually considering it at the time?
Well, there's every opportunity for me. I mean, I got letters from the South African government, you know, forms to fill in and this, that and the other.
What, at that time you got them?
No, later, years later. Years later, see, because they got me address from this chap this, where I was staying, you see. Because she was writing letters home to my wife, telling her that we'd passed through and had a good time. Well, they had my address. Well, he would submit my address to the local office or government office, you see, that I had passed through. And I got this from the government wanting me to go out. But I also remember what he told me.
You spent 4 days at Cape Town. Were you on duty at all at that time?
No, never on duty at any time. I spent a good time. Sergeant Hume and I, when we went with this chap, like, had a free look around Cape Town on our own. Went into hotels. And had a meal and a drink. Then we got invited to a big soap factory, Levi's, I think, Levi's or somebody.
Levi's.
And we got a conduct a tour around there and stacks of cosmetics to come out with, which, you know, is no good to us, really. And again, we were made welcome. Oh, aye.
From Cape Town, where did the boat sail to next?
Bombay. And they didn't want us.
In what way?
Because we were en route in the first place for Madagascar. But while we were on the high seas, the problem in Madagascar had cleared up. So we were switched to India.
Can you tell me how you came to know that you were meant to be going to Madagascar at first?
Well, just jungle telegraph. We weren't officially told. We weren't addressed by any officer. But it came on the jungle telegraph, and which we didn't take much notice of. More so when we didn't go to Madagascar and in Bombay, we thought that, but it had been right. The situation cleared up, and we switched to Cape Town, to Bombay.
Can you tell me about your arrival in Bombay?
Yes, when we docked, there was army vehicles waiting for us, Indian army vehicles. And we got aboard and were taken up to a place called Aminaga. I think it was about 90 miles from Bombay. And we were built it up in this camp. It was an Indian Army camp, Indian Army standards, not British.
Can I ask you, what time of year are we talking about now? What year are we in?
May. January, February, March. About May, because I spent my 21st birthday on the boat in April.
And that's what, 43?
42.
You said the camp was an Indian Army camp, Indian Army style, did you say?
Yes.
What did you mean by that?
Well, the floors was just earthen floors, but they're called mutty floors. No wood or linos, nothing like that, mutty floors. And the walls were thatched. No windows in, just a big square hole where windows should be. And the beds were for sepoys, Indian soldiers, made of bamboo and like raffia. No steel mesh like the original British Army beds. No furniture whatsoever. Each man had a square box, and that was near full of ants, eaten with ants. The toilets was miles away. Ordinary standing up toilet, you know, the. And the canteen.
They weren't flush toilets, just a slit trench.
There were a zinc channel, about waist level, you know, a zinc channel. And you just sort of stood up in this zinc channel with a pit. But the canteen was similar. And all you could get the canteen was bullock meat, bullock steaks. It was like leather. The tea was black, stewed, and the canteen was run by Wasserali. He had the contract for all camps, but he hadn't catered for the British, apparently. Good enough for the sepoys. Of course, to them it was luxury, coming from the villages, luxury. But for the British soldiers, a big contrast from his canteen.
Yes, now, obviously you didn't think a great deal of them.
No.
What about the men? How did they react to these conditions?
Well, they weren't pleased, to say the least. We did try and organise something through the PRI. That's the President of Regimental Institutes. And he did improve things.
In what way?
He made frequent visits to Bombay and brought things back, like crates of beer, coffee, and he even brought tea urns so we could make our own tea the way we wanted it. And he brought cups, you know, of our own making, you know, the cups, the sort of cups we used to, instead of the tin things, tin mugs. and even brought bacon. We had bacon sandwiches, beans, eggs. So instead of going for a bullock steak, you could get a bacon egg sandwich. And of course, rock buns.
Did this improve morale, do you think?
Make people life a little bit different. You're going to get a good cup of tea, and a tea and wad, as we called it. Then, later on, was a rally moved his vendors in. That's the man who carries the tea in on shoulder sticks and a tin box with cakes on his head. He moved them in. That improved the situation because his cakes were pretty good. They were the ordinary rice cake with a crinkly paper around, you know, hygiene, gives you a feel of hygiene. And then the dude waller came around, that's the milkman.